Man, I tell you what, this guy came up to me the other day. He says, "Hey, it's Life in Equinox podcast time." I didn't know what the hell he was talking about, so I just kicked him in the balls, and well, now I'm in jail for assault. And part of my, I don't know, community service is I gotta help this guy out, and so here's my introduction. Hey, everybody, it's Life in Equinox podcast time. I would like to thank Jimbo for that kind introduction. As if anyone's fooled by my horrible southern accent. And you'd think from North Carolina I'd have kind of sort of one. And I have noticed that when I get really nervous, it comes out. You know, a few years back we were on a cruise ship and my parents talked me into going on stage and doing like a hula hoop competition. Let me say this right now. I am the world's worst hula hooper. I think I got one go around and then it fell down on my legs and I was like, "All right, that's enough of that." But they asked me, like, you know, they had a guy up there and he's acting all cool because, you've really made it in the world when you're the host of like a 3 in the afternoon show on a cruise boat. Hollywood, here you come. But he's over there, you know, I was like, "Where are you from?" And all of a sudden, like, my southern instincts kick in and all of a sudden I'm like, "I'm from Wake Forest, North Carolina." Where the hell did that accent come from? It's like, I ain't got much of nothing. What? Why am I talking like this? I don't understand. Good days. Fake southern accents. I don't know. Maybe I think I just start mimicking other people when I get nervous. If only I could start mimicking Sean Connery when I get nervous. That would really help in front of women, because all of a sudden I have this Scottish accent and I sound a little bit like a sexy Sean Connery. But I think the Sean Connery accent I try to do sounds more like what would happen to Sean Connery if he had a stroke and was voiced over by Dick Clark. I don't know. It's a little confusing, but that's not the point of today's podcast. It is back. I know we took a little bit of a weekend off last week because I was out of town, and when I got back, I had way too much to do and didn't have time for podcasting. It's so depressing. But we have a good lineup of things. I am kind of sad. I haven't had a chance to watch a lot of movies this past week. I won't have a chance to watch a lot of movies next week. So I'm going to kind of cover the movies that I've reviewed over the last couple weeks, and one movie that I'm going to review tomorrow. So let's just hop right into it, right? I did get a chance to see Brick, the 2005 film from Rian Johnson, which stars Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who I absolutely have always been a fan of, and I've heard a lot about this movie because I think it's just, as film fans, there's a lot of love for that noir style, I'd say. You know, that really sort of smooth and cool and attitude and direction and sort of blending. And Brick's one of those movies that I wasn't really sure I liked. I'd read a lot of mixed reviews on it. Overwhelming reviews from my people I follow, but a lot of mixed reviews from people on forums. And I always like to go into a movie with sort of a, I don't know, expectation, which, don't ask me why. I prefer going into movies with an expectation than no expectations. I try to do that, and I just always feel awkward. But it's one of those movies that I see why people love it, and I enjoyed it, but I didn't love it. And one of the things about it is I've noticed is it's really dialogue heavy. Like the way the conversations take place, there's so much to that that you kind of run the risk when doing that. And Rian Johnson, who's just a great writer, I absolutely loved his writing with The Brothers Bloom, which is a movie that came out last year and made my top 10 list, and still only way too few people have seen it. But one of the things about it is when you make a movie that's so dependent on the dialogue, and I wouldn't say that Brick's entire life is dependent on the dialogue, but the dialogue is such an important essence of the film. And then you make that dialogue very stylized and very catchy, and you know, you use a lot of slang words, and some of them may or may not make sense. You run the risk of alienating your audience. It's a very difficult thing to do. And I think, for me personally, I enjoyed it most of the time. Sometimes, like during the final sort of conversation between Joseph Gordon-Levitt's Brandon and Nora Zerhetner, I really can't pronounce her name, but she did a great job in this. Laura, who sort of plays one of his quasi-allies with her own agenda girl. During their sort of final confrontation, there was so much slaying, I felt like it kind of detracted a bit from the emotion. And I get that, you know, if they were actually having this conversation, they in their world, they would talk that way. But for me, I kind of wanted to understand what he was saying to her. And so I'm sitting there, you know, I'm pausing the movie, whipping out a thesaurus, you know, what the hell does that word mean? What's another word like it? You know, trying to figure out dictionary.com. Answer my questions. And on some level, I think if you're an English major, you probably, you know, and they're going, I'm in heaven. But for me, I don't, you know, it doesn't do a lot for me. I'd rather just a perfectly well-said sentence than a perfectly well-cool slanged sentence. So there is that, but there's a lot to the story, and I liked that it was layered, and it sort of combines, on some level, it has, I don't know, kind of a comical nature to it. You know, you have, like, the pen who's got, you know, the cane and the black coat and looks like a, I don't know, I hate to say it's like an anime villain. And, you know, a lot of the, just kind of like a very Cowboy Bebop villain. I read on IMDb that that's one of his influences. It really has that sort of jazz, dark, but still kind of slightly comical and intriguing viewpoint on it. And I enjoyed that. And I kind of wished it had a bit more in the sense of the story. At times, I felt like it was a little bit more about the dialogue, and while the dialogue, you know, moved the story along, definitely, I kind of wish there was more scenes in which they would have, I don't know, had action. And I don't mean action as in, you know, gunfights and, you know, running around. Just action in which a lot of real things took place. There's a lot of scenes I felt like, I don't know, there was just kind of a 5-minute scene for 3 minutes of information. You know what I mean? And so there is that, and I'm harping too much on the negative of this film. I do have a tendency to do that, and I apologize. Because there's a lot of great. The style to it is really, it's a visually amazing film. The whole time I was watching it, I was really drawn in by the visuals. And then I really enjoyed the way the performances were, because you have a lot of characters who aren't really that emotional. Laura, I mean, I don't think she displays more than like two emotions the whole movie, and that's sort of her character. And then you have all these other people, actors who really are asked not to do a lot of emotion, and the characters I just found intriguing, and for the most part the performances I think matched. A couple times they were a little iffy, but there's a lot to that, and I think Bricks, I can see why people love it, and I think it's a movie that the more I watch I'll love. And so I'm going to leave that, and the next movie I'm going to talk about is a movie I reviewed almost a couple weeks ago now, and it was Drew Barrymore's directorial debut, Whip It. And we got a lot of polarizing comments on this. Some people agreeing with my post. Some people, for lack of better words, bashing my post on it. And I don't think it was any bashing so much as disagreement. But perhaps it's because I am not a 16-year-old woman or female looking for something like this. When I watched Whip It, I felt a lot of the time, I just kind of felt like I was watching something I'd already seen before. And not in a bad way, but in sort of a, I don't really care way. I don't know. I felt bad because I so badly wanted to care, and I didn't. I didn't really care a lot about the characters. A lot of them felt very formulaic and very undeveloped. And I don't know, I get a lot of the comments I got. I understand a lot of what people say. I can't judge a movie from a viewpoint other than my own, so please don't ask me to. I can't really say, oh, well, you know, if I was this, I mean, I could try it, but I'd eventually end up getting to a point where I'm doing it to a point where I'm probably insulting people. But, you know, the character of Bliss is a good character, and I really liked Marcia Gay Harden's Brooke in this, and it's not really towards the end of it that we really see the layers of her character, but I really enjoyed it because I think on some level she sort of ends up embodying old school ideas, new school ideas, and hopes all in sort of one character, and so I think her character was actually the one I found most interesting. Bliss, I've never been a big fan of the rebellious teenage character. Don't ask me why. It's one of those ones that just never really works that well for me. Mostly because I just always feel like they're being a little bit of dicks to everybody, but they're being rebellious and, counterculture. And I enjoyed the roller derby aspects, but I have to say right now, a quick way to get me to not like something about your movie is to put Jimmy Fallon in it. I'm sorry, I don't find him funny, and every time he talks, because he plays the announcer, because I don't know what it is about sports movies, but even if it's like an elementary school, backyard game, they always have an announcer. What is with that? I don't understand. But I guess roller derby might have an announcer. And he makes a comment, though, about halfway through. Don't worry if you don't understand what's going on, we'll keep the score for you. And I kind of felt that way about the roller derby scenes. They were intriguing and fun to watch. But ultimately, I had no idea what was going on. They grab each other's arms and shoot each other forward, and 4 points, 3 points, 4 points, 3 points, and they'd all look the same to me. And so maybe if I knew more about roller derby, I'd be like, oh, well, that's how that happened. Okay. But for the most part, it all kind of looked the same scene over and over again. But it was entertaining. I did enjoy the Drew Barrymore character because she was just kind of, the funny, goofy one. I like Kristen Wiig. I always have. I think her character here was nice. She sort of plays the same but different to Marcia Gay Harden. They sort of play the two. I don't know. It's amusing because they're kind of the opposite and yet they're the exact same, you know? And I liked that. I liked their sort of dynamic. It would have been nice to have a scene or two with them together. I don't know. Me just wishing there. But overall, I think Whippet's a good movie. I think it should, or could, I shouldn't say should, could's a better word, have been better and more developed. But I think overall, I see why people love it. I see why people like it, and I would recommend it. I think it's just, good entertainment, and it's got a good message, good heart, and that's always top marks. And then another movie I had to see this past week. It's a movie that intrigued me when it came out in the theaters, just because I love fantasy films, and that was The Time Traveler's Wife, which stars Eric Bana, Rachel McAdams, and might just win the award for most difficult names to say of people who are a bit behind the scenes. But, all right, you have the director, Robert Schwentke? Not a clue how in the world to say that. Schwentke. I think someone just put a bunch of letters together and said, boom, we have a name now. But yeah, that does not work for my bad pronunciation skills. And it's based on the novel by Audrey, and I'm just gonna say her last name begins with an N, because each attempt I have to say this name always comes out wrong. And I do not want to get myself in trouble. But Audrey, Niffenegger. There we go. You pronounce it yourself. Hey, you didn't know you'd get a little Sesame Street lesson when you came to this podcast, did you? Next thing you know, I'm gonna start counting. One, two, three, four, five. Today's number is five. All right, I know it's stupid, but The Time Traveler's Wife. I read a lot of it after watching this movie. I went and watched it with my mom. Who, if you were wondering who my mom is, you'll see her comment every now and then under the name Ginger. And we were watching it because we were looking for something to watch. My dad was asleep, and we're like, we need something to do. We're like, haha. And so, we both love fantasy, and I love sci-fi, and I love time traveling. I'm always interested. And one of the things I've noticed a lot with time travel movies is you read a lot of blogs and even professional reviews in which they write, it does the time traveling doesn't make sense. And they list the reasons it doesn't make sense. But if you really read the reasons, it's not that the time traveling doesn't make sense. It's that they personally have their own belief as to what time traveling should be, and it doesn't fit with that. A good example of this is the film Star Trek, early last year. I read a lot of reviews that said the time traveling doesn't work because, and they list this reason, and it's like, but you have to realize time traveling doesn't really exist. So there's no rules for time traveling beyond what we have guessed in other sci-fi works, and maybe what some scientists have guessed. So you can't use an argument based on your own, I guess, assumptions as to something that doesn't exist, you know, the legitimacy of it. It's stupid. And Time Traveler's Wife takes its own take on it, in which this case, our main character is someone who's got a genetic condition. And his name's Henry DeTamble, however you say his name. I'm really botching up names today, and it's, you know, Eric Bana, but he's got a genetic condition in which it, by sort of just consequence of various circumstances in his life, he jumps time. He goes to different points, and, you know, it's interesting to see how it develops. Because I always enjoy watching romances. I know I'm very cynical of romantic comedies, and there's a reason for that, is that I don't buy into the romance a lot of the time. And, but I am a sucker for a romance, a good romance. And this is one of those ones where it's difficult for the romance because the movie starts at two different points. You have the character of Claire, played by Rachel McAdams, who has known Henry her entire life and has loved him her entire life. In the opening scene, she's meeting him and she's like, "I've loved you forever. Oh my God." And you're like, "Whoa, what the heck?" Because, like Henry, this is the first time you've ever seen her. You don't know anything about her. He has yet to travel back in time to meet her. And so it's interesting to see how that develops. And I felt as if the romance was developed well enough. It wasn't, you know, great. It wasn't, you know, a beautiful and poetic romance, like I think it actually should have or could have been. And I keep saying should when I should say could, because, I mean, that's just my personal assumptions. But there was a lot there they could have done with the romance, and I imagine that if I went and read the novel, the romance would have been better developed, and it would have flowed a little bit better. But I think they do the romance well enough to make you care about the two characters. You know, we see the good times, the bad times. You know, we kind of go through the ups and downs of romances, and it's not one of those movies where I would say that the drama's predictable, but it doesn't feel false. And I don't know if I can really explain it, but I never felt like they were trying to force the drama, you know? Which is something I have noticed a lot, especially in romantic comedies where you'll have sort of that, I don't know, third girl who randomly shows up and gets caught in an awkward situation, and now you have drama because the guys all of a sudden change from being a kind-hearted person to a dick for no apparent reason, and you have all that sort of stupid stuff. But it doesn't do that. It keeps it concentrated on telling the story of these two and their romance, the various difficulties and the troubles of it. And I liked it. I'd recommend it. I didn't think it was great, and I don't think it was as bad as some people thought it was. It can be a little fabricated at times, but it never bothered me much. I enjoyed it enough to recommend it. I didn't, you know, I'm not gonna out here going, "Greatest movie ever!" You know, like, I'm not a IMDb forum whore or anything like that. But I should be. There you go. Future careers. Knock that one down. You know what I mean? The people on IMDb, everything they write, "Worst movie ever!" You can tell I'm serious because I'm typing this in all caps. Roar! I don't understand it at all. Moving on to the last movie we get to review and talk about this week. Yay! The official review for this will be up Sunday. And the movie is Edge of Darkness, Martin Campbell's self-adapted from his own BBC series of the 1985, written by William Monahan, who's well known for doing Kingdom of Heaven and, of course, The Departed. And really, its sort of sell point is the return of Mel Gibson. And I don't know how I could best describe this movie. Is you ever watch a movie and everything just feels so incredibly mediocre that you don't really know how to review it? It's like that scene, well, that scene felt very mediocre. The acting in that scene felt very mediocre. The cinematography in that scene felt very mediocre. The directing, the writing, it always just felt very mediocre the entire time I was watching Edge of Darkness. It never felt good, it never felt bad, it always just felt meh, you know? And I don't really. I wanted so much more because it has so many people I enjoy watching. And I really liked Bojana Novakovic. Desmond, if you're listening, correct my pronunciation. Novakovic, I think. A Serbian actress who plays Mel Gibson's Thomas Craven's daughter, Emma. And she's only in a few scenes, but I liked her, and I have liked her for some of the things I've seen her do in the past. And so I had a lot of hopes going into this, and I really just kind of felt it didn't do much. And I don't even think it was my hope so much, but it felt like a lot like when I was watching The Lovely Bones. Every time it had a great scene, it followed that up with a bad scene. Every time it had good acting, it had bad writing. If it had great cinematography, it had horrible lighting. I was so confused because I didn't know what to do. And you add on top of that that once you get out of the I'd say the main cast of Gibson, Winston, Houston, and I'll even say Novakovic, you the acting just kind of hops off a little bit and just kind of goes way down. Even J.O. Sanders wasn't very good in this movie. And like there's one actor, Sean Roberts, who plays David Burnham, who plays Emma's boyfriend. I thought every scene he was in, it just felt like he was really, really, really overacting. I mean, like, wow, I can't believe you're overacting that much. And so they're like, I'm so angry and frustrated. Argh. It's like, man, go take a deuce. You look a little constipated there. And it was a shame because there's a lot going on, and you always run the risk when you're trying to adapt something like a BBC series or a TV show, and you're trying to get the entire story in from, 12 or 20 hours into two. And so William Monahan ends up taking the let's hit all the big notes and just put it in there and see if it works. And I think at times it just kind of feels detached. It feels a little off. We don't get enough into the characters. Even Mel Gibson's Thomas, who we spend the entire hour and 40 something minutes with, we never really get in his head except that he misses his daughter. I mean, that's no real revelation or anything. Of course, his daughter was murdered right in front of him. I think we're not shocked he's having a little bit of trouble. And I can kind of see why this movie's struggled to make money, as despite what the commercials would lead, there's not a lot of action that goes on. It's very much a drama and a thriller sort of film. And a lot of the moments we do is we're watching Thomas kind of go and investigate. And while I love cops investigating scenes, it just felt like, I don't know, he was hopping from one obvious clue to the next, you know? There was never that feeling that, oh my God, he's not going to solve the case. It was always like, let me see what's happening here. And then the guy would be like, I have one thing I have to tell you before I walk out of the scene and out of the movie. You should meet. Dun dun dun, you know? And so I think there's just a lot more they could have done. I think it could have been more well-rounded. It felt kind of rushed to me. And as much as I like Martin Campbell's directing style, I felt like he was out of it. I don't know, he just felt off his game here. Like he was unsure of where to go with the scenes, which I think is depressing because there's enough depth to the story. You can really see why it's such a well-beloved miniseries, but I think it doesn't translate well to film. I don't think it translated well at all here, and I think it kind of got the results that you kind of would expect. I mean, just okay, what's next? But overall, not a bad selection of movies by any stretch. I can see why anyone would want to watch or enjoy any of them. And that's all I'm gonna do. Not gonna have any real big conversation piece this week. Maybe next week. Reminder though, 23 Days of Kurosawa does kick off March 1st. If you'd like to participate in any of the reviews, maybe do a podcast with me on it or something like that, leave a comment, send me an email at lifeandequinox@gmail.com, or do whatever you want. That's all I've got for you, so my name has been Ryan. You can find my blog, Life in Equinox, and Movie Lovers Journal at Univarn, univarn.blogspot.com. That's all she wrote. Bye.